Hey everyone, this is Megan. Preparing for my VBA 2C was pretty lonely at times. This is why I, along with Julie, created a Facebook community for all the parents preparing for their VBACs. You can find the link to the community in the episode notes today, or head over to facebook.com and search the VBAC Link Community. This is our safe space to share our stories, tips, and advice on how to achieve a VBAC and ask each other questions. Just remember, studies show 60 to 80% of people who attempt a VBAC will be successful. We're here for each other on this journey. To join, go over to facebook.com and search the VBAC Link Community and start feeling the love and support today.
Hello, I am with Julie today, and we're going to be talking about failure to progress. If you have been diagnosed with failure to progress, and I say diagnosed because they actually put them on our UP reports like it's a diagnosis of failure to progress, meaning our cervix does not know what to do. It cannot make it to 10 centimeters, or it hasn't, or will not in the future. Then I'm telling you right now, this is definitely a great episode for you. But then even if you haven't been told, it's going to be a great episode because we're going to talk about some other great things in the end about what to do in labor, position-wise, and all of the things. So we're going to get going, but Julie apparently has a review of the week. We weren't going to do one, but she says she has a review of the week. So Julie, I'm going to turn the time over to you.
This is my review. Are you ready?
I'm actually really curious.
I'm so excited. Thank you so much, Megan and Julie. I love being back week. Signed, lots of people everywhere.
Oh.
I love it. We're going to have a review of the week. And so I just made one up. Boom. There.
Boom.
Anonymous. Signed, anonymous.
Hi, my name is Megan. Welcome to the VBAC Link podcast. I am a VBAC after 2C section mama, a wife, doula, and VBAC educator. This podcast was created to hold space for those wanting to know their options for birth after cesarean. It is a space where you will likely find yourself getting better educated, relate to stories like your own, and finding the inspiration to help you have a better birth experience. Although we will be sharing stories related to cesarean and VBAC, this podcast is for anyone and everyone who wants to receive evidence-based information and learn how to avoid unnecessary or undesired cesareans. The purpose of this podcast is to educate and inform. It is not meant to replace advice from any other medical professional.
All right, you guys, failure to progress, what it is and what it isn't. Let's talk about what it is. What does it mean? Essentially, it means that your provider believes that your cervix did not progress in an adequate amount of time, or your, and there's also failure to progress isn't just like, it's not like your body may have gone into, or you're going in for an induction and then nothing, like they couldn't even get labor going, which we all know is usually not the case, that your body really couldn't do it. But failure to progress when your cervix does not continually dilate in an adequate amount of time. Would you change anything about that, Julie, or add anything to that?
Sorry, I didn't hear half. I was just going through the things just to make sure that we're like 100% accurate on what we're about to say. Whatever you said, yeah, that sounds great. No, yeah, let's go with it.
Failure to progress. The cervix is not dilating in an adequate amount of time.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Failure to progress is your cervix. Your cervix isn't changing, so got to do a C-section because it's not working.
Yep. Basically. Okay, so what it isn't? Do you want to talk about what it isn't?
What it isn't? It isn't really... It isn't most of, sorry, I'm trying to
say. It isn't true most of the time.
Most of the time, it's not true. It isn't what we think it is. It isn't. Mm-hmm. And if it is, it's not a sign that your body's broken. It's not an exclusion. It's not a reason to exclude you from trying for a VBAC. It's not your fault. It's not, or what it is, like usually a failure in the system or a rush or people in a hurry. And just not knowing how to move past the stall in labor and not understanding the true flow of how some labors take, right? I mean, I was diagnosed failure to progress. You were diagnosed failure to progress. And I know that both of our literal clinical outlook at the time we were diagnosed with failure to progress mm-hmm. was not true failure to progress.
Mm-hmm.
According to what the actual guidelines and requirements are. And so I always say, yeah, what you said, it is not true. I know that we joke around that and use it loosely. And sometimes it really is true. I've seen one true failure to progress diagnosis in over 100 births. But like, I feel like most of us listening, most of us who have had C-sections have them because of failure to progress. Now, mine, when I was in labor, I was not told failure to progress. I was told fetal heart tones, but that's another topic for another episode. What we're told mm-hmm. versus what is in our op report. So yeah, let's do a little plug-in about getting your op report, like finding out what is actually in the notes that say why your C-section was called, because it's not mm-hmm. uncommon for what it was written down to be different than what you were told in the moment. So I feel like having mm-hmm. an accurate clinical understanding of what your cesarean looks like on paper, like to another doctor that's reviewing your birth, is super important.
Absolutely. I agree. And also, I think that it's important to note that if you have been told this and you have doubt in your body, that is normal to have doubt, because we've been told something like we can't do something, right? Our body can't dilate. But I also want to plug in that really try not to believe that. Do your hardest. If you can, do whatever you can to not believe that it's going to help you. Believe the opposite. Believe that your body can do it. Believe that you were most likely set up in a less ideal circumstance that created result, right? Like an induction with, I mean, it was a failure to descend, not progress. But like, I just recorded a story the other day where her water was broken at 6 centimeters, baby came down wonky, couldn't get baby out. They diagnosed her with CPD, right? So there's these things that are happening a lot of the time where we're walking in to be induced way too early, or really any time we're being induced could be too early, you know, especially if it's just an elective, it can definitely be too early and our body's not ready. So our body's not responding maybe, or our body's overwhelmed because it was big. It's been given so much so fast and it doesn't know what to do. And so it doesn't react the way a provider wants it to mm-hmm. by our cervix dilating. And it like almost is reacting in the reverse way, where it's like tense and tight and like, no, I'm not ready and I'm not letting this baby out. I'm like, don't you feel like you've seen that?
Yeah, I mean, just a lot. We've seen lots of things. I feel like that's like the tricky thing. Like we as doulas and birth photographers, we really do get to see the whole gamut of everything from home to birth center to hospital and everything. And I feel like we just have such a unique perspective mm-hmm. on how labor is managed in and out of hospitals and how stalls or lulls in labor are managed in both places. And let me tell you, it's often way smoother and, in my opinion, way better outcomes when you are out of hospital and that happens. So
mm-hmm. laboring at home as long as you can. Yeah. I mean, one of the stories that I just recorded was an accidental home birth. It was not her plan, not even close. And it will for sure come across that way when she's telling the story. But it, you know, there were so many things that she did within that labor, like movement from the shower to the toilet, to walking down the stairs, to moving back to a toilet, like all this movement that sometimes doesn't happen in a hospital. Or we've got, like I said, let's break your water, let's do these things. And we've got these interventions that may help, but doesn't always. It may also cause problems. So, okay, so we have some updates for you on safe prevention of a primary cesarean delivery that Julie has found. And then we also want to talk about what is, you know, adequate labor too. Like, what does that mean? And where do we decide, or where does a provider decide if labor is not adequate? So Julie, do you want to talk about this form that you found from the OBG project?
So there's a couple little things. So that's just a really nice summary. I like it because it's all laid out nice. Yes. I'm seeking out different pieces of information because there is updated information. And so I'm just kind of looking for that. And I'm not quite 100% certain I can speak to when it came out, because it looks like, I mean, evidence-based birth has some great information. They did a podcast episode on the Friedman's curve, right? So like, we know that like the dilating 1 centimeter an hour is based on this study that Friedman did. That's just like incredibly flawed. But there was a new updated, more evidence-based information that's come out. And I'm trying to find out when it came out, actually, because the Friedman curve was established, I think, in 1956. And let's see, in the 2010s, there was big shifts in the evidence. So like in 2014, ACOG and the Society for Internal Fetal Medicine published new guidelines on labor progress. Okay, so 2014, it looks like, which is actually not that new anymore because it's 10 years later. In that was, I think, so I don't think it's actually shifted much at all. I'm just trying to figure that out right now. I'm sorry. Let's see. So the practice bulletin.
Well, so there's
yeah, you go.
The safe number prevention of the primary cesarean delivery. I think we're looking at different.
We are looking totally. At
approaches to limit interventions during labor and birth, but we know that a lot of the times when we're introducing interventions, that is where we often will receive a failure to progress diagnosis, because we're really introducing things, like I said earlier, when the body's not quite ready or the baby's not quite ready. Like maybe the baby's too high and was already trying to make their way around and into the pelvis, but now we've got an asynclitic baby or a transverse baby or an OP baby. And so this one, the number 766, which we'll have it in today's show notes, it was actually originally, it replaced the committee opinion of 687 in February 2017. The 766 was in 2019 and reaffirmed in 2021. And something that I kind of like that it goes through is like recommendations for women who is term and spontaneous labor is happening. It talks about like admission upon labor. It talks about premature rupture of membranes or rupturing of membranes, which I think is a big one. Like really, I think through my own experience, but then also doula experience, I've seen so many people go through membranes rupturing, whether they're artificially or just spontaneously, and then nothing's happening. And so then we go in and we get induced, or we're told the second our water breaks, we have to go in, then labor's not started yet. So then we're intervening. And so one of the things it says, when membranes rupture at term before the onset of labor, approximately 77 to 79% of women will go into labor spontaneously within 12 hours. And 95% will start labor within 24 to 28 hours. So I just had this experience with a VBAC client just the other day. Her water broke, and within about 9 hours, she was starting to contract. And within less than that, like, she actually progressed really quickly. Baby was born. So that was really great. But then, like, there are situations like myself where it takes forever for labor to even start, right? It took 18 hours for my very first contraction with my second baby to even start. And then by 24 to 28 hours, I was in a repeat C-section, right? Mm-hmm. Because my body didn't progress fast enough, according to my provider. So it says that the median time to delivery for women managed expectantly was 33 hours, and 95% had delivered by 94 to 107 hours after rupture of membranes. So I think that is something also really important to note, that if your water breaks, it doesn't mean we're just having a baby right away. It doesn't mean that our body's failing because we haven't started labor, right? I mean, 94 to 107 hours after rupture of membranes, the baby had been born. Like, that's some time. We need to allow.
That's why I hate it when hospitals say, oh, if your water breaks, come in right now, right away.
I know. No, I know. My provider did that too, right? And it makes sense because in our heads, because they're saying, oh, just come in because we have to monitor baby because infection and all this stuff. But we also need to take a step back and realize once we go into that environment, one, that's a new environment. We're not familiar to those. All of those germs in that environment, we're not accustomed to. We're not immune to, right? And then two, we know that the second we go into labor and delivery units, what happens? They want to check our cervix, mm-hmm. which means
bacteria.
There is bacteria that is possibly being exposed to the vaginal canal, right? Even if mm-hmm. it's a sterile glove, that still raises chance.
Yeah, sterile gloves aren't really not as sterile as
so right. Like it's just so there's these things to keep in mind, but it's so hard because for me, I had premature rupture of membranes. My body didn't start labor, but I was told failure to progress. After 12 hours for only reaching to 3 centimeters, I was told failure to progress. So I just really liked that. I mean, I liked this a whole bunch of this, but I really liked that part of the rupture of membranes because I think so often we are told, oh, your water is broken. You're not progressing. You are failure to progress. Or we're not progressing, so we have to break our water to try and speed our labor up, and then that doesn't happen, and then we're failure to progress.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see the problem here?
Total problem.
It's a problem.
It is a problem. Like, so many problems. It's fine. I just dropped a link to two different links for you to the updated guidelines because it's really funny because I've kind of been going down the rabbit hole now, like while you've been talking. So if I'm repeating things, like I tend to do on you sometimes, please forgive me. But I just think it's interesting. So there is starting to be a shift in pulling away from the Friedman's curve and going into a different way to consider natural progression of labor, which is really mm-hmm. cool. Nice mm-hmm. little shifty shifts here. But like, I feel like maybe let's talk about like what failure to progress like really is. Like, what are the guidelines for it? What,
yes.
What is real failure to progress versus what you've probably think been about told. Or what you've been probably told about it. So first of all, let's just talk about, yeah. I don't know.
I would love to first use of all, nothing. Can we use my example, my own birth example, just as a starting point to what this evidence is showing us or what the guidelines are? So my water had broken, mm-hmm. okay, spontaneously, took a little bit to start labor. Within 12 hours, I was 3 centimeters and was told that my pelvis was too small and that I was failure to progress. So water broken, I was 3 centimeters. 12 hours into labor. All right, Julie, what am I? Am I real?
No,
failure to
you're not.
Or not?
Okay, absolutely why? Not. Are you kidding me?
Why?
Because you were still in the first stage of labor.
Exactly. I've not.
I mean, that is like the number one thing that like it cannot, like according to clinical guidelines, it is not failure to progress until you're in the second stage of labor, which is at least 6 centimeters dilated.
Yeah, it says
so
right here.
Guess what, friends? If you got called failure to progress before you were 6 centimeters dilated, mine was labeled failure to progress at 4 centimeters. So that automatically rules me out. I mean, there's lots of things that rule me out and Megan. But if you are less than 6 centimeters, it is not failure to progress.
Yeah, so it even says right here, active phase arrest is defined as a woman at or beyond 6 centimeters dilation, yep, with ruptured of membranes who fails to progress despite 4 hours of adequate uterine activity or at least 6 hours of oxytocin administration with inadequate uterine activity and no cervical exchange or cervical change. So can we talk about that too? Adequate.
How much time?
Uterine activity. You guys, at 3 centimeters with my water broken, I was still not in an active pattern to progress, right? So it takes time. Our uterus doesn't just start contracting and just boom, 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 start contracting regularly and adequately, right? It takes time. And then at that, I was only on oxytocin for 2 hours.
Pitocin, you were on Pitocin.
Sorry, that's what I meant. Pitocin. I'm looking at the word oxytocin administration.
I got you. I know.
Pitocin.
I know.
We all know the truth. Pitocin is not oxytocin.
Yes. That's another soapbox for another day.
Pitocin. Okay, so I was only on Pitocin for 2 hours. Two hours. So up at the top, it says slow but progressive labor in the first stage of labor should not be an indication for a cesarean. With a few expectations, prolonged late phase greater than 20 hours in a first-time mother and greater than 14 hours in a in a mom that's not the first-time mom should not be an indication for cesarean as long as the mother and the baby are doing well.
Yep.
Cervical dilation of 6 centimeters should be the threshold of an active phase of labor.
Exactly. And I mean, like, that's it too. Like, first of all, second of all, later on, after this, we're going to talk about all the different ways cervix can change. Because can I just tell you what? Somebody says, oh, I'm 5 centimeters. I'm still 5 centimeters. Great, cool. But like, what else has your cervix been doing, right? But we're going to talk about that in just a second. But yes, that's the thing. It's not failure to regress before 6 centimeters. It has to be 4 hours of adequate uterine activity, which means strong, consistent contractions. Contractions that are strong enough. So yeah. We could talk about like the Montevideo units, which is another measure of strength of contractions, which we won't. We're not going to talk about that because we just don't have time. But like, are your uterine contractions strong enough? Yes. Then it's got to be at least 4 hours without cervical change. No. Then great. Let's do Pitocin and the inadequate amount of uterine activity. It says 6 hours or more of Pitocin without adequate uterine activity. So if you've been on Pitocin for 6 hours, and your contractions, which has caused the adequate contractions, and still no cervical change, then your failure to progress, right? So let's talk about cervical change though, because the cervix goes through so many things. When I was doulaing, I talked about this a lot, like in our second prenatal visit, about how a lot of times you'd be like, oh, cervical change, yeah, dilation. Am I 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, right? But listen, the cervix goes through changes in 6 different ways. It moves forward, so from posterior, pointing backwards towards your spine, it straightens out to more downward position. It softens, so it's like goes from like hard like your forehead to hard like your nose to like softer like your chin, right? Softens. It effaces, which means it thins out. So it starts thick, it thins out, which is effacement. Dilates, obviously, which is the opening. And then baby's station, like where baby is in the pelvis, baby drops down, rotates and descends. So if you are 3 centimeters at your last cervical check and 60% effaced, and 2 hours later at your next cervical check, you're 3 centimeters and 80% effaced, your cervix has thinned by 20%, which is a good amount of cervical change. You're 6 centimeters and your baby's at a -2 station, and your next cervical check, you're 6 centimeters and your baby is -1 station, which means your baby's lower in the pelvis. That is a cervical change. Like all of these things are shifting. And so I feel like it's important that when we're talking about failure to progress or when we're talking about labor progress, that we consider all the things the cervix does. Like I was just at a birth yesterday, not yesterday, 2 days ago. I don't know. It was all night. It was long for me. All night is long. It doesn't matter if I was there for 6 hours or 20 hours. If it's all night, I feel like I'm going to call it long anymore as I'm getting older. But the client was still 4 to 5 centimeters, but the cervix was a lot softer or stretchier, I think, at the one before this. Oh, yeah, your cervix is super stretchy now. Mm-hmm. Like those are all great cervical changes, even though the dilation number
hasn't changed.
Right?
Yeah. So coming forward, thinning out, really softening up, baby dropping, all of these things are signs of progression. And so it's something to keep in mind. if a provider is like, well, you've been sitting at 6.5 centimeters now for 9 hours or whatever, but at the same time, your cervix went from 40% to 80% percent thinned, and it went from super posterior to more midline, and baby mm-hmm. went from -3 to a 0. These are changes. These are absolutely yep. changes. And there's so many things that go into that, right? If a baby is high and not well applied because they're trying to work their way down into the pelvis and our cervix is working on coming forward, there's so much that goes into that where we got to get, now we're going to have a baby. If that change was made, now we can maybe have a baby that's well applied to the cervix, creating good pressure, uterine activity is getting stronger. Things are progressing in the right way. And so yep. in the ACOG thing, it does say that in contrast to the prior suggested threshold of 4 centimeters, which we know was very outdated, the onset of active
right, labor- that was according to the Friedman's curve, right? Yes. So Friedman curve is called active labor at 4 centimeters. But now we're getting all this new information that shows, yeah, like it's probably more like 6. And I feel like when me and you started as doulas, like 9, 10 years ago, it was 4 centimeters, but a couple years after that, everything started shifting into 6, right? So it's actually not that
yeah.
new, but kind yeah. of new. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah, well, I want to get into our positions really quick, but it does say even in here, the onset of active labor for many women may not occur until 5 to 6 centimeters, may not occur until then. And then we even mm-hmm. know that sometimes around 6 centimeters, it takes some time. So we're going to make sure all these links here are in the show notes, so you can check it out.
Hi, birth workers. This one's for you. In an ideal world, VBAC parents would be treated just like any other birthing parents. In today's world, most medical providers sadly don't fully support VBAC parents. However, 90% of parents with a prior cesarean are good candidates to attempt a VBAC. This is why we have created the Advanced VBAC Doula Certification Program. In this doula course, we share evidence-based data for you to educate your clients, teach you the tools on helping them how to process past fears and trauma, or helping them decide if VBAC is even right for them. You will feel better prepared to support them during this beautiful experience. All VBAC certified doulas are listed on our website so parents know who you are. To learn more, go to thevbaclink.com.
But we only have a few minutes left, so I really want to talk about positions, okay? So positions, in my opinion, can truly change.
Yeah, how do we, if there is a lull in labor, they're getting close to calling a C-section, what can we do about that?
Yeah,
you know, like, because nobody wants to hang out at 4 centimeters forever, right? Like, no, just nobody does. So what can we do about that? Yes, Megan, sorry, go ahead.
Okay, movement. So if you do not have an epidural, obviously movement is a lot more free. So moving around, just walking, just flat out walking. If we've got a higher baby and we're trying to get a baby down, really think about that femur rotation turning out. So you can walk, and sometimes I've had my clients, we do this like little step dance thing where you like step really wide and out mm-hmm. and then really wide left, you know, then right, then left, then right. And so we're doing this like weird looking dance thing, but you're grooving, right? And that can really help. Or thinking about like really big asymmetrical movements. So like put your leg up on the bed or on a stool or on a whatever, and leaning over, bigger movements and outward movements. If you have an epidural at this point, same thing, rotating on your side, really opening those knees up really, really wide and trying to keep those movements consistent. Now, if you're exhausted and you got an epidural because you need sleep, I really, really believe in sleep and I think it's very powerful. So find a good position, sleep in that position, and when you wake up, get going, get active. But, you know, every 5 or so contractions, if you can, if not, make it 8, make some changes. It doesn't have to be too dramatic. It sounds weird, but if you're at home, like crawling up your stairs on your hands and knees, it's weird, but it works. Or standing up and down, like going from the side, you know, one side going down, standing back up, turning, you know, or walking back up, turning around, doing the other side down, coming up. Those things are going to help, doing big figure eights or hip dips. As the baby gets lower, all of those things really are still important, but we're going to be less focused on big, open, wide, because now we're going to want to get baby in and then down, right? And so if you think about a pelvis femur rotation out, bottom goes in, femur rotation in, bottom goes out. So thinking about these movements as you're laboring, as you're working through these things, as you're in these positions, thinking about our hips, our pelvis, like even doing some cat-cows in labor, that is really good. We know there's like flying cowgirl. That's a really great one in labor too, to help get baby down and in.
Walters.
Walters, like that's not as fun, but it can be very effective.
But it's magical. I've seen it like
totally works.
Push labor through so well. Like I had a doctor once at the U come in, and I had a client who was 5 centimeters. Baby wasn't looking too great. She'd been 5 centimeters for a while, and we were doing Walters. And they came in because like the heart rate, Walters sometimes it's hard to get a fetal heart rate when you're doing Walters. And so the nurses come in and they were talking about C-section and like they like prepping, like wheeling in or bringing all the C-section stuff for her partner to get ready. And they're like, you can't do this. Like baby's heart rate is not tolerating it. I'm like, no, it's just like you're not picking up the heart rate or whatever. And I'm like, okay, just one more contraction. And then one more contraction later, she comes up and then starts pushing like 2 minutes later and her baby's born.
Yeah.
And then the doctors are like freaking out because, oh my gosh, the bed's not designed to labor like this or whatever. Not everyone, sorry, but like those are a couple little pushbacks I've gotten sometimes, but like
it's weird looking, it's funky,
it's weird looking. Uncomfortable. Yeah, it's curious. Like it's just like, and some staff at hospitals do not. If they see something new and they don't know about it, they automatically assume it's not good.
Yeah.
Because they need to keep everything in line and to the protocol and all those things, right? But like, yeah, it's just really a magical thing.
There's also abdominal lift. So you can abdominal lift. I think that actively moving, if I can speak, through the contraction, which can get really hard in that active phase, but through the contraction can actually help hands and knees, sacrum, all those things. Holy cow. There's so many positions.
Yeah. Can I just touch back? Like when you said about an epidural, like I love like when you're not resting, I think sometimes it's easy to get discouraged if you want an epidural, but you also want to move during labor. Right. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to kind of expand about a little bit on that because you can move with an epidural still. And here's the way you do it. Like I love my favorite labor position with epidural is sitting up in the throne. So you lay the head of the bed all the way up, drop the feet down, and then you move the peanut ball, like crisscross your legs, put the peanut ball under your right leg, 5 contractions later, peanut ball under the left leg, 5 contractions later, crisscross your legs again or stretch them out straight or whatever, and then repeat. And do you know what? Like I just like there's so many magical ways that helps. It just keeps your pelvis moving and shifting and growing. And I swear that is the most magical position for laboring with the epidural because you're upright, baby's going to move down, pelvis is moving and shifting, still creates lots of movement and space. And I have seen that progress labors relatively quickly to how they have been going before we set up in the throne so many times. I love that. Yeah. Like I will swear, I will die on that hill that if you are a failure to progress, things aren't moving, sit up, drop your legs, give the peanut ball back and forth. Or it doesn't even have to be peanut ball. Maybe you don't have one in your hospital, but like stack a couple pillows or like pick one leg up, like put your foot flat on the bed so that like the knee's kind of forming a triangle. I don't know how to make the right, describe it the right way. And then drop it and put the other leg up and then crisscross your legs and then stick them out straight, like two little sticks. Yep. And like there's just
every five,
you don't have to have
five,
these big dramatic movements.
Yes, I would say every five subtle changes. Every five subtle changes. Keep that in mind when you are laboring. Women of strength, know that failure to progress is rarely truly failure to progress. We get it. We've been told the same thing. We see it all the time as doulas. There's more. And don't feel like you have to say okay to a cesarean if your cervix hasn't dilated to a certain amount that provider is wanting. Assuming you and baby are doing well, you can always ask for more time. Okay, yep. We were kind of on a soapbox. We could probably continue for a whole lot longer. But Julie, thank you for joining me today talking about failure to progress and what it is and what it isn't.
Would you like to be a guest on the podcast? Head over to thevbacklink.com/share to submit your story. For information on all things VBAC, including online and in-person VBAC classes, the VBAC blog, the worldwide database for VBAC doulas, and more, head over to thevbacklink.com. Congratulations on starting your journey of learning and discovery with the VBAC Link.